So let's get started with our first speaker. Dave Saylor is a professor in the School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning and director of the Urban Climate Research Center, both at the Arizona State University. Dr. Saylor's research focuses on the intersection of climate with the built environment. This includes investigating feedback mechanisms between the built environment and climate, with a focus on building energy consumption and renewable energy resources, as well as both indoor and outdoor thermal comfort and air quality. A key element of his research is on quantifying the causes and prospects for mitigating the urban heat island effect. Dave is a national expert on heat islands, so I'm very happy to have him here. He's going to kick it off with an overview. So go ahead, Dave. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Victoria. And I'd like to start by thanking EPA and Victoria for organizing this webinar, and thank you for letting me be part of it. So as this is an overview presentation on understanding your city's urban heat islands, and I've added that S as really an emphasis to reflect the fact that the concept is really much more complex than a single number. And so for any city, you can define actually multiple heat islands, but I'm going to get into that in the coming slides. So as a starting point, in order to be successful in understanding your city's urban heat islands, you must first understand the underlying definition and its complexities. So I'll start with that. But then you need to ask yourself, what is it that I really care about? And only then can you really determine what it is you need to measure and how best to make such measurements. So let's make sure that we're all on the same page to start with a definition. So it'll seem a little simple at first, but hopefully by the end of this brief presentation, you'll have an appreciation of the complexities associated with the seemingly simple concept of the urban heat island. And perhaps you'll even reconsider how you phrase your questions about heat in cities. So going to the glossary of weather and climate, an urban heat island is simply defined as an area of higher temperatures in an urban setting compared to the temperatures of the suburban and rural surroundings. It appears as an island in the pattern of isotherms on a surface map. Another common definition is simply that the urban heat island is the difference between urban and rural temperatures. But this definition by itself is really vague and not sufficient. So if we want, say a single number, as many people do, really how would we define, let's say, urban, or how would we define rural? Are we interested in the largest difference during the daytime or at night, in summer or in winter? And more fundamentally, are we interested in surface temperatures or in air temperatures? So before digging into the definition, let's consider the causes of urban warming in the first place. So this is a little graphic that I tend to present when I'm talking about urban heat islands. Specifically, urban areas differ from their unbuilt surroundings in a number of ways. So this includes a rough urban surface comprised of buildings of various shapes and sizes. This urban roughness affects the flow of air over the city, both in terms of slowing airflow patterns, but also increasing turbulent mixing and channeling flow between and around buildings. The urban canyons that are formed by these buildings have an effect on trapping both shortwave radiation coming from the sun, but also longwave radiation emitted from urban surfaces. As a result, cities tend to store heat during the day, but are less able to cool off at night. And this is in contrast to the unbuilt surroundings that cool off rapidly at night. So urban areas also tend to have relatively little soil surface and moisture and vegetation. As a result, they're less able to cool themselves through evaporation of water. And finally, the intense amount of energy consumed in cities, what we refer to as anthropogenic waste heat, leads to large amounts of heat emitted into the urban atmosphere, particularly in the early morning and late afternoon hours. So the net result of these various contributions to the urban climate system is urban warming relative to the surrounding unbuilt or rural areas. But this warming varies, as I mentioned, from summer to winter and from day to night. In fact, as a general rule, the air temperature urban heat island is largest overnight and in the winter. So if you were to do a Google search right now on images under the heading, you just type in the words urban heat island, you're likely to find a lot of images that either replicate this image or are slight variations on it. Even though it's a little misleading to summarize the heat island phenomenon as a single figure and to focus exclusively on late afternoon summer air temperatures as this one does, this figure actually has been the driving force behind a lot of heat mitigation efforts. So, you know, it's not easy to really generate simple, pretty pictures of, say, the air temperature variation across a city, but this can be done if you take a large number of weather stations and do a spatial interpolation, or through empirically based models such as the one that I'm showing here, the results of some of the work that we did in Portland, Oregon in the summer. In fact, these images actually are able to show variation in near surface air temperatures that you would not see in the corresponding maps for surface temperatures. Specifically, they show that on that the variation across city and the variation of the urban heat island depends on weekday. So if you're on a weekend, which is these top figures, the top figure rather, or a weekend or a weekday, the images look quite different. And so that's evidence of the role of anthropogenic waste heat emissions in affecting urban air temperatures. So it's interesting to contrast the kinds of images that you generate for air temperature heat islands with those that you get when you look at surface temperature heat islands. Specifically, if you do a Google search on the term heat islands, like I said, the most common image that you'll see will be the type for the air temperatures. The next most common image that you'll see is something like this one here that happens to be for Boston. So this is a colorized version of data that can be extracted from satellite imagery such as MODIS. It's a representation of the variation of surface temperatures across the region. Since surface materials exhibit a high spatial variability, however, such as you can have concrete right next to dark asphalt, the surface temperature plots like this can show large variations in surface temperatures, especially when you view them at finer scales. And both types of plots, whether it's air temperature or surface temperatures, are representations of the urban heat island phenomenon, but they're fundamentally different in what they represent and really how they should be used. So what do we care about? Do we care about the surface temperature heat islands or do we care about air temperature heat islands? Well, my answer is that I think we care about both and more. Specifically, if we're interested in pedestrian thermal comfort, the air temperature is very important. But so too are the surfaces that radiate heat to the person. So these are not just the ground level surfaces, but also walls, but not so much roofs, right? So your surface temperature heat island that you might get from a satellite is composed primarily of ground and roof surfaces, but does not include walls. Of course, ambient humidity and exposure to the sun and wind are also very important in determining thermal comfort. And these are less commonly considered when you think about urban heat island mitigation. So that's one thing I want to emphasize here is that it's about a lot more than just temperature. So before I transition into talking about measuring air and surface temperature heat islands, I want to give one cautionary note. So this actually comes from a research article published by Ian Stewart in 2011. He systematically evaluated published reports of urban heat island magnitudes and found that roughly half of them, in his words, provide estimates of UHI magnitude that are unacceptable. So to paraphrase, half of what's out there in the peer-reviewed literature on here urban heat islands is garbage. So we have to be really cautious when we're moving forward. So anyone considering measuring urban heat islands would really be advised to take a look at this article and its recommendations. Some of the key recommendations are making sure that measurement sites are truly representative of the land cover that they purport to represent. This includes both the urban and rural sites or areas being used in any UHI calculations. Following standardized reporting guidelines for site metadata, disclosing details of instrumentation and estimates of uncertainties in the data, and also being careful with terminology. Specifically, we should never use the term the heat island by itself. because it's really not sufficiently clear. As I've already talked about, there are many heat islands to be considered. So furthermore, I would suggest that we use the urban heat island concept sparingly. It's useful, it is a useful way of explaining key aspects of the urban environment, but do we really care about differences between urban and rural temperatures, or rather, do we really care about the absolute temperature felt in cities? So for that matter, is temperature really the endpoint that we care about at all? Or is it some other endpoint, as Victoria mentioned, such as human health, energy consumption, or air quality? And all of these are influenced by temperature, of course, but they're also influenced by additional aspects of the urban climate system. So, for example, with thermal comfort and heat-related mortality, we're very much concerned with peak daytime temperatures, but we're also very concerned with humidity levels and minimum temperatures at night. So let me move on to measuring thermal environments, focusing on air temperatures at first. And when it comes to air temperatures, there are a range of types of measurements that we can use in our studies. These include traditional weather stations. These are some of the highest quality air temperature data that you can obtain. The data are reported hourly, and long-term records are kept. However, if you're trying to use these for heat island studies, you're usually limited to only a handful of first-order weather stations in any city. There's also networks of lower-quality stations or cooperative reporting stations. These are great because they also tend to provide hourly data, and there are a lot of them in this country, so I think there are over 7,000 just in the U.S. They typically report the hourly data, but the metadata on the instruments and the site information is maybe not quite as good as what you find with the National Weather Service sites, and sometimes siting and maintenance can be questionable. So care should be taken in using those sites. Another type of measurement that you can use in heat island studies is the mobile traverse, and that is where we use vehicle-based traverses to gather extensive data for model validation. It can provide some of the spatial coverage and control that's not available in some of the fixed stations. Of course, the problem with traverses is that they're typically conducted by small teams of researchers, sort of on an as-needed basis, maybe as a before and after test for evaluating the thermal environment in a city. But they just give you very limited temporal coverage because, again, they're just episodic. And finally, I just want to throw out there this notion of crowdsourced data. I think as we move forward in the future, there's growing potential for using a wide range of data sources from citizen scientists, including things such as having thousands of people walking around a city have their telephones reporting the battery temperatures, which actually can then be related to air temperatures through fairly sophisticated QAQC protocols. So it's important to note that the accuracy of air temperature measurements depends on a number of factors. So we tend to think of sensor type as being the primary thing we care about, and we oftentimes refer to our measurements as being accurate to plus or minus a tenth of a degree because that's what our sensor is accurate to, but that's not the case. While sensor type helps to determine the upper limit on the accuracy of sensor systems, some of the other considerations are things like the temporal response characteristics of the sensor, how fast they respond to changes in conditions, errors introduced by the instrumentation system itself, but perhaps most importantly, errors introduced by placement of the instruments and their housing conditions. So you should take care to ensure that the air temperature being measured by your system is actually what you think you're measuring or what you intend to measure, and that this temperature is really representative of the air temperature in the area of interest. So for example, if you're trying to measure the air temperature of a neighborhood, it's worth noting that, you know, a single measurement in a backyard of one house may not be sufficient. The temperature measured there will most certainly depend upon whether the yard has grass or shade trees, whether it was recently irrigated, or whether, you know, that yard happens to be irrigated more or less frequently than its neighbors. So, and then, of course, also when you start siting stations in neighborhoods, there's lots of issues with placing sensors or weather stations just too close to very warm, thermally emissive surfaces like brick walls or concrete walls. So while fixed temperature stations have one set of challenges, the mobile traverses that I mentioned have other strengths and weaknesses, and so I think these in combination can actually be very valuable. These traverse results that I'm showing here for Hong Kong show the expected local air temperature elevation in the central district. But again, these are just for one snapshot in time. And if you're trying to evaluate the performance of a heat mitigation strategy with, say, before and after measurements, you have to be very careful to ensure that the underlying weather patterns for the before episode are comparable to those after. So let me move on to measuring surface temperatures. So remote sense data from satellites and other high-altitude aircraft offer great potential to gather fairly detailed estimates of surface temperatures across large areas of the city. The maps that you get from these sources tend to be very compelling visually, at least. Of course, one drawback is that these measurements ignore contributions of vertical surfaces, which is very important. They also require that the radiometric data that you get directly from the satellite be turned into estimates of surface temperatures by first accounting for the attenuation that happens in the atmosphere. And even though some products like you know, the satellite data that you see are typically presented as being, you know, the gospel truth for the surface temperatures, they can often have temperature measurement uncertainties that are on the order of several degrees Fahrenheit. So handheld infrared cameras are another option. They can provide both information about horizontal surfaces and vertical surfaces. We have used these in ground-based traverses, but we've also flown them in helicopters and you get some really useful data that way. In the end, though, regardless of the type of radiometric platform you use, these surface temperature estimates are not typically what we're interested in when we think about urban climates as urban climate scientists or policymakers. Typically, local air temperatures are more of interest and as they're more closely tied to the outcomes that we care about. And relating the surface temperatures to air temperatures is still, I'd say, a developing field that introduces additional uncertainties into the estimates. So you have to take any estimate of air temperatures measured in the city with a grain of salt, really. So in summary, I'd just like to emphasize a few things. First, it's important to be careful in defining your measurement objectives. This seldom has anything to do directly with urban heat island magnitudes. Once objectives are set, you can consider designing your measurement and analysis system, but it's often difficult to approach the ideal system given limitations in real urban environments. That is, you can't really cite instruments where you'd really like to. And finally, be cautious in conveying your results. Provide metadata. First of all, gather metadata, but then provide it to describe how measurements were made, report uncertainties, and be clear in terms of what the reported data represents. So that's all I have for this overview. My contact information is shown here, and I'd welcome conversations, particularly with cities who might be looking for academic partners for designing and conducting mitigation experiments. We're open for business. Thanks.
That's great, Dave. Thank you so much. I think you did a good job of providing the context for this whole webcast. And the takeaway that I bring is that this can be really complicated. It can seem daunting, but if a city or anyone who's trying to assess their heat island, if they really plan ahead of time what their approach is going to be and think clearly and thoroughly about these different considerations, if they do that before they actually dive in and start using sensors or using satellite data, then it is possible to come up with a good result that achieves the city's goals. So before we go on to John, we wanted to do the audience participation part of the webcast. We have a poll question. We will have three of them. And these are really for EPA, for us to get a sense of the communities that are on the line, what level they are at with this topic. And so that helps us to, you know, learn how we might be able to help. and it will help you all understand who else, you know, what about yourselves on the line. So I'm going to read the question, and then Brad is going to give the answers. The first question is, what is the main reason that your community is interested in reducing urban heat? Are you wanting to protect public health? Do you want to reduce greenhouse gases? Do you want to decrease energy use, increase resilience, or do you want to improve overall community livability? I know that you probably would want to select more than one, but to make this useful, please just select one. Take about a minute or two to let us know which one is your main reason, and then Brad will be back on the line with the results. So let us know what your answer is.
Okay, we have some results. So it looks like improving overall community livability was the lead, and the second was protecting public health, and then to increase resiliency, and then a tie between reducing greenhouse gases and decreasing energy use.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for participating. I think this lines up well with what you'll hear from Cambridge and Baltimore.